Gaming on the Frontier. This is Bruce.
And this is Trav.
Welcome to Gaming on the Frontier, your podcast of not always having to do the slog through the jungle or the mountains or the desert or the dungeon. Sometimes you get to take it easy.
Well, I guess I can repolish my sword again for the fifth time.
Is that what you're polishing?
Well, I was going to add, and this time maybe I'll even go to the armory.
Welcome to Gaming on the Frontier. This week we are talking about downtime. We're talking about what does your characters do when you're not on the main quest? You can just simply take that time to make a little extra coin, because not all games are Dungeons and Dragons where you get a big score off of a treasure hoard at the end.
Well, maybe some games are Dungeons and Dragons and you're using your craft skill to either make magic or mundane items.
Well, yeah, I play an alchemist, and the last time I had a week off, I spent the entire week making alchemical grenades. So that, because they were like, we're underpowered for these foes we're heading up against. I said, okay, fine. Give me a week. I made 21 of them, and they each did 5d6 damage.
Oh my lord! Yeah,
in a twenty foot radius. Yeah, I mean, but we were being attacked by a hordes of slimes that were going to be resistant to most of the stuff we were trying to do. So you stab it with a sword, it takes half damage. You shoot with an arrow, it takes half damage. Unless you have a big flat head on a hammer or a thunder wave or a concussion grenade, which deals force damage. So I did that. That was how I spent my downtime. And the GM gave me experience for doing it. I ended up spending money, not making money. But you can also use it to make money. The last week we had off, we just had, one person went out and basically took a shift at the local Adventurers Guild, and they basically cooked and served meals for a week and got paid 350 gold pieces and gained a point of reputation with the guild, which is important because that gives you bonuses on gets you first choice on certain kinds of quests, and they also gained experience. But that wasn't the only thing. There was somebody wanted to find a certain set of herbs and mushrooms. Somebody wanted somebody to go on a shopping trip and buy stuff for them, like a personal shopper. And the difference between what they thought, the thing cost and what you got it for was your pay. So the better you were at haggling, the more money you would make. Okay. There was one where you literally were a bodyguard, which of course all the fighters jumped on that. And so there were like all these different things you could do that wasn't quest related, but you got paid for it. So they, I did the dumb thing. I basically said, well, I'm an alchemist and they need alchemy. They need someone to do stuff, to test reagents and things like that. And I spent the week doing that, which gave me a couple of reputation points and some money. And I was like, but I would have gotten the same amount if I would have been a cook, or if I would have, gone on the mushroom hunt. That would have been fun. And I might have even, improved my herbology skills or something like that, because that's something I don't normally do. I'm mostly beaker kind of alchemist.
You're usually in the chem lab. You're not out getting herbs for reagents. Yeah, you usually buy your reagents. Yeah,
and that could have actually, if I did it enough, the GM might say, okay, now you are proficient you know, with using the herbalist kit, you know, or something like that, and you get a plus two, you know. But that's it would have been different than what I normally do besides adventuring, and you know. So that would have been fun. I would have enjoyed that. I have a little homunculus, homunculus, that is a flying cat that smokes. And I'm like, you know, if they'd had like some kind of, you know, pet race or something silly where, you know, here in Atlanta they had this thing called Halloweeny, which is all the wiener dogs get together with their owners, and they dress them up in costumes, and they have a licking contest, and they have a chase the snack contest and things like that. You know, I mean, come on, we know it. It's just fun for people to get together and show off their pets. So, I would have had, if someone had something like that, I would have loved to have gone and done that, because then I could have shown off my little, you know, my thing, you know, my homunculus. It's a cute little black cat with wings, you know. With it also has hands, it has prehensile hands, so I use it to help me around the lab a little bit. But primarily, it's a pet. Yeah. So I'm just saying that kind, you know. And if you have a pet, okay, in the game. I have another character that had two, like, mastiffs who were, you know, she called Satan and Tiamat. You know, she'd love opportunities to go and show those dogs off and, you know, have them do tricks and stuff, you know. But she doesn't really get a chance to do it because when we're gaming, they're coming along as guard dogs. But, you know, it's not like you don't get to have fun with them other than saying, well, while we're, you know, after I feed them, I basically play with them because they're dogs. They need playtime, you know. But there are things that you can do, you know, with pets and such, you know. So, and you can, and the GM again, he or she can reward you with saying, well, you picked up a level of animal husbandry, dog, or animal husbandry, you know, platypus, whatever it is that you got.
You know, there's classes that have, like, either familiars or animal companions. And let's say you either have lost one or you, for some reason, dismissed it. Let's say it got awakened. Which, you know, there's the awakened spell, the druid spell. And, yeah, it was cast on your dog. Well, he's not really an animal companion anymore. He's now your equal. Replacing said animals. Going to, and let's see here. Folks, as I said, I printed out pages 84 to 87 in Ultimate Campaign for Pathfinder. Well, let's see. We're animal companion, one day performing a ceremony, you get a new one. And for a familiar, you got to the mouth works, folks. Wait at least a week to, and then a day for the ritual to get a new familiar. So, yeah. As far as animals go, gaining new ones, if you've somehow lost either familiars or animal companions, that can be done in this time. So you get the new cat or the new crow or the new mouse or whatever it is, or the new wolf if you're a ranger. Or, let's see, some really weird one. Well, it also depends on your environment. Yeah, I have an animal companion. It's this, you know, and I think it's actually on the druid list, a dolphin.
Nice.
Yeah. They have expanded lists. I'm like, okay, you have a dolphin animal. What? And you want to go to the desert? What? No.
No. That's bad. But if you have a lot of boating in your campaign, and you live on a sea coast or even along a river, you know, it can work for you. You know.
It's just when you were talking about having time with your animals, that reminded, oh, and in case you have to replace an animal due to, or train a new one, that's another one. Let's say you want to add, because they have the handle animal skill in Pathfinder, it's like, oh, I want to teach my dog how to, you know, fetch or guard or attack, or there's like a roll which has like 4 to 6 tricks, taking time to train the animal to do this new stuff. That's something else you can do. Yeah.
Yeah, your animal might be pregnant and it might be time to drop some offspring.
Yeah.
You want to be there for that, and the animal's not going to be able to come with you on a mission because they're large with litter.
Yeah, yeah.
I just read a joke today, you know, and it says this recipe calls for leftover bacon. Well, you might as well just ask me for unicorn flanks or
right, exactly. Yeah. What? Yeah, especially with fur in her house. What is this leftover bacon you speak of? We can't even let it sit on a plate without Ramses going after it. Hell, he reached in a frying pan while to get the bacon while it was still cooking. Yeah.
You might need to do research on something, like go to some library or something, or you needed to practice a skill that can't be done as part of your normal routine. You know, like I don't know if you've ever seen a loom, but those aren't things. There are small looms you can carry with you as you travel, but most looms are pretty drawing room sized. Okay, and you're not going to be, you know, doing that while you're on a mission. So, you know, and if you're planning some downtime so you can work on something that you're trying to do, it is good. And it might be required, you know. It's if you have to, you know, if you're learning how to work in a machine shop, again, unless you're in a spaceship that has a machine shop in it, or you have a really big van, you know, that, you know, which we've done in Bureau 13. We had two vehicles. One was the Colorado R&V, and the second one was the machine shop that was inside of a big, you know, cargo van. And so they could, like, make stuff, fabricate stuff when they needed to. But the point is that, you know, you don't learn how to do that just overnight. Because, yeah, we had all these characters that had skills in fabricate plastic, fabricate metal, fabricate this and that. And they're like, well, okay, so when do I actually get to use these skills, you know? And how am I going to use these skills without some place to do it, you know? Because now, of course, a lot of stuff you can do with your 3D printer. You know, you just have, and it'll do it itself. But I mean, for the longest time, you had, it's like the A-Team, you know, things got bad and all of a sudden they would get captured by the bad guys and thrown into a warehouse. And they turned around and it was full of machining equipment. And they don't go, oh, you know, don't throw me into the briar patch, you know, briar fox. So, next thing you know, the door's opening and they're coming out with the minivan turned into an attack vehicle, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, also with research, not only researching like, oh, I need to research about this next mission we're going on, and so we need to go to the library and consult the sage and all this. Also, if you have a spellcaster like a wizard, you need to either add spells to your spell book, or if you are creating a spell, because Pathfinder does have rules for creating new spells, being in the magical library and looking up stuff about, okay, let's say I want to do a cone of cold that will encase their opponent. And I had to do that. Cone of cold, and I think icy form is the other one. And so there are rules, okay, the level times 7, that's how many days you have to read. So yeah, it's, you're researching stuff for your class. And usually spell research is the big thing. And it's spell, I think mostly wizards. I don't, yeah, let's see, bards, sorcerers, oracles.
Well, in the original D&D, not original. When I say original D&D, I mean AD&D. I had the original blue box, but as soon as I heard about Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, I'm like, what am I spending my time on this for? Let me go to that. They did come out with Master's Editions of D&D later, but the point was that AD&D was a big step up. And in AD&D, whenever you went up a level, you didn't just magically go up a level. You were ready to go up a level. You had to find somebody to train you, and you had to basically spend as much time as you were in your current level. You know, like if you were second level, you had to spend 2 weeks training to go to third.
Oh yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And it cost you 1,500 gold pieces a week to do that. So it was like, I want to go to third level. That's going to be, you know, 3,000 gold pieces plus 2 weeks' time, you know. And that's even assuming the GM isn't making you roleplay, getting the person to train you. And at the end of which, you gain the benefits from that. But it's like, literally, you cannot go up a level until you do this thing. So you have to plan for your downtime. You have to save your money during the journey from your treasurer, or borrow money from other characters so you'll have that money so you can go up, you know, and do that. And he's like, I cannot go on another mission until at least 2 weeks or three, whatever it is, until I finish training. And they're all like, really? Okay, but that's good, because then they now know they have X amount of week of time for them to start planning their downtime as well. So it doesn't have to be twiddle our thumbs until the bard has gone up to their next level. I think they really in 5e and all around, I think they lost that in a negative way. I realized it was a very expensive thing to do. And but I thought it added so much to the game that you really felt like your character, you know, was learning something. It wasn't just magically they were there. Sometimes you need to do stuff that's going to basically take you out of the main flow of whatever genre it is that you're doing. It's part of the genre, but it's not part of the main quest or story that you're trying to tell. But it's important. It can be an important part of it. You know, it basically, sometimes it's one of those things that makes sense for your character to be doing, you know, that there be some downtime for that. You shouldn't ignore it. You know, the GM, you need to tell the GM, yes, I need to do this, you need to let me do it. So, because sometimes the GM's like so hot for moving on with the adventure that they have planned in their head, that they don't want to take this time. And, you know, it's like...
And see, that's kind of... Okay, how can we do it? What's the term I'm looking for here? I guess quiet railroading would be a good term for that, just because he's so fixated on...
Yeah, the worst thing that happens is where you say, I want to do this. He says, well, funny you should say that, because this just happened.
Well, yeah, but I mean, if they're so fixated on their plot that they don't want to do things to help round out the character, like downtime activities, in a way, I kind of see that as light railroading.
I agree.
They're so fixated. Yeah, okay, all right.
It is, because you're literally telling them that you want to do something, and they're telling you, no, you can't. You know, we had a whole episode on saying yes, and you should definitely, all GMs should always try to say yes to whatever their players want to do, and especially if it's something that helps them develop the characters that they're playing, okay? Also, we did an episode on pets. I recommend that you look back on that one, which also could give you some good ideas about how to get involved with your pets, your mounts, and other things like that, which could have some downtime related things to do. Of course, one of the things that you don't do, you hardly ever do in current D&D, and sometimes it depends on other types of games you're playing, but recruiting new members to your team, you know, because we all know how it really goes, right? You know, someone gets tired of playing their character, they give a half-baked announcement of, oh yeah, my character decided that he needed, you know, to have, you know, go buy a house in the Catskills, and in the meantime, this other character he's contacted his second cousin once removed, and he's going to come in and join the party in his place, and he's X. Okay, well, that's terrible. Okay. Which I think is a much better way is to do what that we did back in first edition D&D, which was you recruit
you recruit people for your team from a bunch of NPCs, but also a PC, and you make that person who's bringing a new character in work for it, you know, because the GM says, okay, he's going to bring in a third level character or an experienced whatever it is. Okay, I'm going to bring up about four or five other experienced characters that are not exactly the same as that character, but also has some of the core skills that they're talking about bringing to the table, maybe some other skills, and have a recruiting meeting where you basically, you know, like Peter Graves, you know, at the beginning of Mission Impossible, looking over this you know, bunch of pictures and dossiers, and deciding who his IMF team is going to be this week. You know, now, of course, it's always the same ones because that's the cast. But theoretically, you know.
Or like Justice League Unlimited, where they pick the heroes based on what was needed at the time.
Right. Well, that's what you should be doing. Right. But, you know, and sometimes people play that way where they have a, you know, they say, here's a group, you know, we're going to make like 10, everybody make two characters, you know, and then depending upon the mission, the character that's most appropriate will work the mission. The other character will go do other things, downtime stuff, okay? And that's a perfectly valid way of doing it. I mean, yes, it means your characters aren't going to be, you know, leaping up through levels or gaining experience points like crazy because they're not constantly working, but it's much more organically, it makes more sense, you know, for the characters. And you end up with characters that are better fitted to the mission if you do that. So, you know, it's otherwise, what you end up doing is you say, okay, you know, we're this kind of hammer, so we have to always look for this kind of a job. And if someone says, well, here's another kind of job, but you're not really well suited, you're like, oh, gee, you know. Or if the events of the campaign change and you start heading more in this direction, then either you have to morph your characters into what you need, which can be okay. It's really true and fringe-worthy where you start off as a bunch of low-level, random people picked from all over the world, and as you go along, you start becoming a more coherent team with your skills all interweaving and meshing, but you still end up becoming more focused in one type of mission. Yeah, I'm just saying, if you're constantly running into new missions would completely, this one's a political mission, this one's you have to be merchants, this one you're all a bunch of pirates, this one you're adventurers to the Arctic, this one you're space travelers. I mean, the players look at me like, how are we going to succeed at anything with this guy? Every mission is different, Bruce. And I'm like, yeah. That's what it's like to be an explorer. And they're like, but. So having extra characters that you can swap in and out isn't necessarily a bad idea, you know? And that way you don't have to have like six different teams that you're playing, you know, switching back and forth between them and taking six times as long. It's like being a first level character with multi-classing. You split all the experience points between the different classes. You're not the way they do it in 5e now. So it's but yeah, I mean, it's.
And if you do that in a Pathfinder game, they have the minimum XP rule. Let's say it, you know, it's like when, and we've done the episodes on when players can't make it to games, what you do for them. You would give, let's say I have character A, and I run character A for like three sessions, however long this particular mission takes. Character B would get the minimum experience as if they took care of an obstacle equal to their own challenge rating. So if they're a level one character, they would get the award for taking care of a CR1 creature for three. So they'd be behind a little on experience, but they wouldn't totally be left behind. And then when character B gets their comeuppance and they're on the team, character A would get the three or four levels of times of minimum XP. So they'd be still rising in level, And, you know, one would catch up to the other every so often and just, yeah, I think I might try that. We're making two characters this campaign and you're going to be alternating between them depending on the mission. That might be a future character campaign concept. I might want to try that. I never thought of that, doing the pick and choose, okay, for this type of thing. That would be an interesting concept. Thank you. Yeah, just...
You have to be careful where you end up running into, you know, because if you do try to learn all the skills, you get what's called skill dilution, okay, which still... You know, again, first edition Tri-Tac, if you've never done something before, it was a -6 to doing a task you've never done before. So having one level in something meant that you're no neophyte. You actually, you know, and I had characters that would have 20 skills that had 1 point in them just to avoid that -6 modifier, you know. And when I say -6, that was like a -30 modifier, okay, because, you know, like on a d20, you know, so it wasn't like -6%.
No, it was yeah,
it was a big minus. So, you know, anything we could do to avoid. And I even had people, you know, because of backgrounds, they had 0 on the skill, but it still showed that they knew something.
Yeah.
They hadn't qualified enough, but they weren't totally unfamiliar with the subject. So, you know, we game the system like crazy in those days. Just trying to avoid that. But yeah, you know, so that's a big problem for a lot of people is skill dilution, which is you never get good at anything because you're trying to be
jack of all trades, master of none. Yeah.
None, definitely master of none, and not even close to a mastery, you know, just, and, you know, but it's sometimes that's what you need. Sometimes you need somebody who can just do pretty much everything. Now, Savage Worlds gets around that by having a jack of all trades feat where, you know, an edge. Where if it's something that is smarts-based, intelligence-based, then as long as it isn't an exacting task you're trying to do, then you can just roll your smarts die instead.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you can be a Renaissance man or woman, you know, by that rationale, you know, so. Anyways, yeah. So, yeah. Of course, we mentioned like recruiting new people. Sometimes you just need time to plan stuff with the rest of the players. You know, you say, look, you know, what do we want our next mission to be? What is there something we want to concentrate at? Is there a part of the world we want to continue our adventuring in? Are we tired of this area? You know, have we exhausted all the local dungeons? Have we, you know, I'm always like, you know, isn't Daredevil ever going to, you know, get rid of all the gangs in Hell's Kitchen? It's only like 10 blocks square.
Yeah. And you would figure after a while that it's like, maybe we don't want to be in this part of New York City because of the guy in the red jumpsuit with no eyes on the mask. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, maybe you can't ever get rid of Fisk. Okay. You're not going to get rid of all organized crime, but at least, you know, the little old ladies should be able to go and get their, you know, be able to go from the bank, the post office to the bank with their retirement check without getting jumped by a bunch of ne'er-do-wells, you know, because you've basically settled the streets down for a while, and maybe you're ready to move on to something else, or you know, stop being a street-level superhero and become a more regional superhero, you know?
Yeah, go from street-level to four-color, yeah.
Right, or, you know, maybe you want to, you're tired of being a grounder, and you want to get out into space and go to another planet because you've been having all these adventures here at the spaceport and never actually gone on a ship. So, you know, or go mine those asteroids, you know, or the rings of Saturn, or, you know, become a gas jockey and start scooping gas out of the rings of Jupiter and Saturn and selling the condensate to the local you know, population series. I mean, there's reasons to say, hey, let's try something different. And but you need to sit down and work that out with your with the other players, and you can just sit down and do that. That can just be the session. You just sit down and do that, and no time passes, but that's not very organic. So, you know, you can instead, you can do it as a group in character, you know, and maybe do something else while doing it. Maybe this is, you know, you have a party, or maybe you have a poker game, you know, where you're basically gambling money from each other, you know, or maybe this is the time that you actually sit down and trade for magic items, you know, and while you're making these plans.
Yeah, I okay, my Hinterland campaign, and I told you I got a Robotech guy in there. Well, fine, they made a sub. And of course, you know, it's a, you know, and yeah, I know there's the carnal squids and everything, but they're zipping along. Past two sessions have been the 6-hour sub ride back from the northwest corner of New Akron down to the southern border of the Environ. Past two sessions have been planning, okay, we got these two new enemies. How are we going to deal with them? And just, yeah, so periodic planning meeting with the, and they're all on board. They're just talking on the bridge while the captain's running things. JT and all the rest of them are going, well, yeah, we need to do this. And for this enemy, we need to do this. We need to do recon over here later. Yeah. And it's all been role played. I've been sitting here with my coworker, Joe, and then Fur, Carrie, Gina, Beth, and Courtney are all there on Skype. And we're just plan, and I'm sitting there writing down the notes on 3x5s for to remember later. But yeah, you can have entire sessions, nothing but role-playing tactical meetings.
And you may not gain experience for it, but you can set yourself up to gain more experience later. Because if your GM is worth, you know, anything, they're going to give you awards for exceptional play.
Oh, yeah. Well, I give rewards for the role, because a lot of times they have to make skill checks and stuff to figure, okay, you're going to need this. Yeah, give me a tactics check. Okay, you've come up with this. So, yeah, I give them, because they're still role-playing. They're still doing all this stuff in character. And so, yeah.
Even if you don't do that, you know, if you have a game where you have milestones, and by planning better, you actually reach that milestone faster.
Yeah.
Then overall, you're going to be gaining, your rate of gaining experience points is going to be greater. So, you know, it's may not seem like you're gaining a benefit, but in most of our role playing type sessions, you know, not very much gets done in the sense that, you know, you fight, do, especially if you have combat. It seems that all role playing systems seem to have really slow combat. Okay.
Yeah.
Or you, you know, but if you plan ahead and say, okay, we're going to do this, this, and this, and you know, this is how we're going to approach this, then when you need resources, they may just dovetail in, you know, organically, and instead of you having to go and find things that you need, they show up because you literally ordered them in advance, or you had NPCs going and doing some of your legwork for you, you know, and. Yeah. And basically it can turbocharge your adventure and give you better results, which means that you might end up with better treasure, or it might mean that the GM gives you more experience because you did, you know, did things a better way. Because as you mentioned, Trav, in the original Tri-Tac, you gain more experience from not engaging in combat. You know, you got it. And so therefore, if you plan ahead in such a way that you don't find yourself having to go to combat to achieve your goals, you gain more experience.
That's also true in the Palladium system. Sabita used to play D&D, and he was like, yeah, it's all combat-based. There's nothing for thinking. Actually, you gain more experience via planning and doing stuff than just going in and killing something. And so, yeah, it's if you have sound tactics in one way or another, either depending on how the experience system is based
or your tactics and how it plays out, you're generally going to get more experience because you did it, how can I put this, more efficiently, I guess would be the term? Yeah, more efficiently. Yeah. Sounds right. Yeah.
But in an organic way, it's not like you're racing through the adventure. You're just already dealing with the impediments and making them not really important. Nothing the GM has to slow you down with.
Yeah, and in the second world, the setting, you know, that we linked up with Bureau 13, they have this place called Tempest Argon. And yeah, it's sort of a magical university, but they're field archaeologists. They'll sit there and plan out. They will get every bit of research. Okay, we're going to go into this dungeon near the waste, which in the second world is like near kind of New England, sort of like maybe Vermont, New Hampshire area there. And they will research the crap out of that dungeon. They will get maps. They will get scrolls. They will get local records. They will do divination if need be. Because one of their mottos is, if you just go into a dungeon and start looting, you're stupid, you deserve to die.
Right, because you won't be prepared.
Right, that's the whole thing with Tempest Argon. They will tell you, you're going to this dungeon? No, you get everything together, you find out what type of traps the culture was prevalent in making, where the location was, what are the monsters, what are the natural problems, like, are you going to be, you know, breaking through a wall and finding out you're flooding it because there was an underground river nearby. You need to find out every single thing you can before you get to that cave entrance.
Yeah. Is there a river of lava in that dungeon? That's going to make some changes.
Yeah. Liquid hot magma. Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be something hard to cross over. So you might need some fly spells or if it's magna, you know, which means it has a really close association with the elemental plane fire, there might be some Denzians of those that might be crossing over and being in the vicinity.
Yeah. Planar breaches and whatnot. It might, you know, because of, And it's a trope in D&D, I've noticed in other fantasy games. Oh, yeah, well, if you have a lot of something like, oh, near an ocean or up high in the sky or deep underground or near magma or lava, those planar breaches to those elemental or possibly para-elemental planes might come to play. And it's like, yeah, I'm just thinking this is an old goblin dungeon. All of a sudden I'm fighting a djinn or an ifrit. Wait a minute, hold it. I didn't sign on for this. Where was this on the map back there? Yeah. So spending time researching, yeah, you're going to find out or find out as much as you can. And it's time well spent.
And I actually have dovetailed, you know, the adventure like that. I had a D&D group. They went into a dungeon. There were goblins. They're goblins or kobolds. I can't remember. You'll know when I, and they were about to fight them. And I said, wait a second. He says, you know, Victor, you're playing a drow, aren't you? And he's like, yes. And they said, the goblins go, oh my goodness, it's the Dark Lady. Oh, mistress, we're sorry. We didn't mean to fight you. We didn't realize you were there. Oh, and they're all bowing down and stuff like that. And they're like, well, this is great. We don't have to fight these guys. They'll give us anything that's of value because the drow's with us. And then I'm like, of course you realize that they know about drow. Why do they know about drow? And they're all like, oh my gosh, there's a way to the Underdark here. And all of a sudden they're like, oh my goodness, yes. Well, maybe we want to get this treasure and leave and go back and find out a little something about the Underdark before we go any further.
Yeah. Before we find that one secret door with the stairway.
Yeah. Now I'm adding Drow Patrol to the list of random encounters for that dungeon.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, it's that's why research. I mean, of course, if they had done the research ahead of time, then I that wouldn't have happened. And I'm glad they, in this case, I'm glad they didn't, because I,
you know, because I was able to pick up on that and play it. And they had a great time with that. She actually ended up later recruiting them as her personal army. And
there you go.
And making a homeland for them and getting them actually citizenship in the kingdom. This tribe of goblins, because they were like, you know, she trained them properly. She taught them how to speak proper common, you know, taught them how to keep their money and how to, you know, how gave them skills that they didn't turn around, say the only way we can get nice things is to beat people up and take the nice things from them. You know, once they learned that they actually had trade goods, they could, or, you know, they could use their weaving skills to make trade goods, and they knew how to grow herbal funguses and take that and sell it to alchemists. And so she basically just raised this tribe up, you know, from Stone Age into at least Bronze Age.
Gave them the concept of civilization and barter and currency. And
And once she outfitted them in proper armor, people stopped treating them as if they were something they could just shoo away. Oh, you know, let's just send a couple of first level adventurers to go and kill their entire tribe. You know, which is, of course, what was the original plan.
The original plan for them all along. Yeah,
yeah. But now, you know, they're like, well, no, we can't do that now. And besides which, they're paying taxes. So the local Burgermeister's like, no, you can't kill them, just leave them alone. But they keep keep coming in and lurking about our stalls and things like that. We think they're stealing. He says, or they're shopping. Do they have money?
Yeah.
I mean, they may have more money than, you know, their patron, the Drow Mistress, is rich. They may have more hard coin than you have on you. You should be nicer to these people, you know. And
that's where you just look and point to the player who's doing that and going, racial profile.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Bad, bad, bad. Yes. Shame on you. I love when I get to do that.
These goblins are people too. Yeah. Yeah.
And then, of course, you push them to, you know, wholesome monster girl group on Facebook where they have all these really hideous monsters that are the sweetest, cutest things when they're with their guys, you know, because it's female, you know, but it doesn't have to be. There's occasionally they'll throw in a different one. The weirdest one I have right now, that I'm looking at right now, is it's this goblin that apparently is immune to acid, okay? And it lives inside a gelatinous cube. And they just have this relationship. And every once in a while, you know, things happen. Like it ran over a keg of polymorph juice. And all this, and then the thing turns into like this slime, but it's now a big buff human look, you know, male looking slime. And she's like, I didn't know you had it in you. Yeah. And, you know, and but then he changes back because the stuff runs out. He says, okay, well, he says, you know, and they just have this fun relationship sliding around the dungeon together, you know, because it kills things and she gets treasure, because like when it kills, like the most recent one, it ran over this barbarian type, you know, and she's like, you know, do you have to kill another one? And then it pump, you know, basically blows out this set of, it's basically chainmail bikini, but it's magical chainmail bikini. And she's like, you got me pretties. Thank you. You're the sweetest. So she's putting, I'm just saying, it's hilarious. And, you know, and it's one of those things they do. So anyways, the point is that you're, you know, I love doing that. And one of the things that used to tick off the players when I was playing in D&D is that they would go and they would kill, like, you know, the hobgoblins or something like that. I'd say, all right, the goblins aren't really dead. They're just at zero or below. Okay, so I'm gonna fix their wounds and I'm gonna heal them up to zero, one point, so they're awake.
yes, they're, and now I'm going to interrogate them. And if they respond well, I'm going to offer them a job. And all the other players are like, what are you doing? He says, we defeated it. The GM's still going to give us experience points for it.
And actually, defeating without killing, you can get a higher reward because you're not basing it purely on the kill ratio. You've put it out of commission, and you might, you know, get a little extra for.
Well, you get two things. One is that you get, you know, you get their language ability, because like sometimes it's like they know common and hobgoblin. You may know only common. Now you have somebody who can talk hobgoblin to other hobgoblins. Okay, they can be a spokesperson for you. You pay them well, which for them could be a very low amount, because, you know, it says, what's the treasure on these hobgoblins? Oh, they have like 2 gold pieces. I give them 10 and say, look, you're working for me now. And they're like, oh, okay. I think that's, you know, how is there going to be more of this? This is what you get every week if you while we're adventuring, as long as you don't betray us and you're helpful and you do whatever I ask you to do, you know, especially protect me from, you know, that strange, you know, shifty looking guy that we call Rogue, you know, when I'm sleeping, you know, and they're like, oh, okay, sure. And meanwhile, you've got like, you know, a torchbearer, you got a meat shield if you're playing a mage, you got, just one other person who could gang up on, in third edition, you had somebody who could provide flanking. Even if they couldn't hit the monster, as long as they were still there, you got flanking. So I'm just saying is that, you know, this is like a, you know, 1.5 or 2 hit die hobgoblin that you were just going to kill and loot and move on. You know, you're making so much off of this. Okay, so. But that's this. I'm sorry. This is a tangent.
Well, I was gonna say I had another one had to do with the Friday game, but yeah, if we're still got a few more things to go, yeah, we can wrap that.
Right. Well, I kind of finished up my list. So you said you had more.
Yeah. Let me see here, because as we've been going through, I've been checking up. Okay, don't need this one. Don't need that one. Okay, I'm seeing here. Let's see. We have the list here again from Add Spells to Your Spellbook. That's research. Construct buildings. I guess that would be research or practice a skill that can't be done in your normal routine. Okay, that's out. Craft magic and mundane items. Okay, those are out because we already covered them. Gain earn capital. Yeah, money-making day tasks. Okay, boom. Earn XP. If you've missed a campaign session or otherwise fallen behind in XP, you can spend downtime adventuring to help catch up on the other encounters that are much easier. I suppose that would be scouting out a mission location okay.
As you said, the research, the more you know about where you're going, the better you're going to be at doing whatever your task is.
And okay, gather information, as in the gather information, well, again, in Pathfinder, it's now wrapped in as part of diplomacy. But yeah, that's research. Okay, heal others. All right, yeah. Lead your kingdom. I suppose that could be...
That's kind of
periodic planning
meetings? Or personal obligations. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Promote a business. Increase interest in a business, temple, organization, or other local fixture. You can also spend one type of capital depending on what it is to promote the business. I suppose personal obligations. If you have a tavern, you're going out and, you know, saying, hey, you know, come to my tavern. We got this, you know. Okay, we already did the animal companion familiar. That's the whole thing with pets. Recruit for an organization. Recruit new members of teams. Okay, research a spell. Research facts and lore. Rest, retrain, run a business. That would be the personal obligations again, or money-making day tasks. Scheme for an upcoming adventure. That would be the scout out a mission location.
And planning.
And, yeah, and then train an animal. The 4 pages here, yep, those are done. I can get rid of those. Okay, yeah.
All right. Well, then I guess we're done.
Yeah. I can tell my little thing real quick about, turning a potential enemy into friends.
Please.
Hardwired Hinterland. Again, I'm wrapping up that Friday campaign, and, Fur is playing Hundred Eyes for Marco Polo. So 13th century Chinese. And if you watch Marco Polo, you know that Hundred Eyes was the monk that Kublai Khan, played by Benedict Wong, had. Okay. And there are the Tuvans, which are sort of Mongolian kind of people. There's actually an environ with them. I sent a Mongolian army after Hundred Eyes. It's like, okay, no, we know about, we have people from Kublai Khan's era, and they told us about you disappearing. We heard you were here. We're coming to take you. The Salem era witch that is in the team, played by Courtney, and my coworker Joe, playing the half-blue dragon bard from Fair Rune, they use diplomacy and perform skills. And Joe's character, System Drifter is the name of the bard. He ended up doing throat singing. I said, okay, make her perform the singing. To do that Mongolian throat singing, if you've heard it.
Oh, yeah, I have. That's weird. It's very weird. But yes, I like it.
It's cool, yeah. And they do it in Marco Polo because they show festivals that Kublai Khan is there celebrating. All the other lords are there. And they got these Mongolian throats. There's also a Chinese-Mongolian, Hangai. And they do a bit of the throat singing. But between the perform singing and then the aforementioned Salem witch who has the cooking skills, Sarah and System Drifter now have an army of 1,300 Mongolian soldiers at their service. One of them is now System Drifter's cohort, and I checked out Tuvan names, Altan. Because he's a bard. No, you're Alto now. Alto, come with me. We're going on this mission. Okay, sir. You know. And there was actually where there was a big battle and Sarah was there. And here comes the Mongolian army. And they're all chanting, protect the cook, protect the cook, protect the cook. And they charge the oncoming army because they see Sarah's about ready to get wiped out by this, and here comes 1,300 Mongolian warriors. Because they cooked them a nice meal, and the dragon, half-dragon, did some throat singing. They now have this Mongolian army at their disposal. And I did the leadership rules. I said, yeah, Joe, yeah, your cohort and followers is about a 10% of this army, though, and the other 90% will follow your followers and cohort. He's like, cool. So, yeah, it's... trying to sway your enemy to become your friend is a time-honored tradition in tabletop role-playing.
And if you use the drama deck from Steve Wollett, they even have cards that allow you to do that without you having to worry about, you know, whether you can make that persuasion check.
Yeah, I have them all printed out. Problem is, I don't have a single group where all of them are sitting down at the table. I would have to, send them the PDF.
No, I just take pictures of them on my phone. Since they have Skype, we do it all through Skype. I just basically just post them into the chat on Skype and just say, what, you know, put the names and you just pick your card and order the names that you're on in the thing, and that way they all have a card for each session, and either they use the card or it acts as a +2 to, you know, which. A +2 would be like a +2 on a 20-sided die, you know, to improve some role, any role you want. It could be damage role, it could be a success role, it could be whatever, and it could be a saving throw. You could add to your saving throw. I mean, and that way they have this one thing that they can do, and then of course I always say, well, you have to explain what it is that happened that gave you the bonus, because that throws it. As the role-playing game, because they're a drama deck, you're supposed to use it. You know, of course, if you use the card as it's in the spirit in which it says, then you get, basically, it's going to happen 100%, and you get to then really have to narrate what just happened, so.
Yeah. Oh, God, I wish I knew offhand the site to go to for people to get that. We'd have to look it up, and I'd have to dig through the email. Heck, yeah, but.
Steve Wollett, I mean, I know that the original cards are no longer, you know, they're gone. I have his prototype deck.
Yeah, so do I.
Has all the misspellings.
The clockwork drama, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Ah, okay.
But I'm just saying, is that I'm sure that if you contacted him, and he is on Facebook, he could point you to either a place you could buy it, or he might even just send you the PDF.
Yeah, Wollett is his last name. It's pronounced like the thing you put in your back pocket and store. So it's Steve Wollett, yeah. It's a friend of Blix's, one of Blix's original gamers from like 35 years ago. Yeah. So we met him at Gen Con. Yeah.
And he's also, he's big into like amateur film.
Oh, yeah. No,
he did a movie recently where he was like the producer and stuff. So
Jack B. Nimble. Yeah. I hawk it on my show during my plug session. Blix was in it. Yeah.
It's a very creative thing, and it's kind of like what Savage Worlds does with their adventure deck, except it's much bigger. And yeah, lots of times when I'm dealing the cards out, you know, sometimes the card is completely inappropriate to the situation or the genre or whatever like that. So I just toss that aside and I pull another one till I get a set that could possibly be used in the gaming session, and at which point they either step up and use the card. You know, or they use it as a plus two. So, you know, it's, and I love them because, you know, there's so many, you know, I think we've gotten better than this, but for a long while, and I'm talking decades, people thought, well, the GM is in control and the players are at the beck and call of whatever the GM wants to do, you know, and, you know, he's the game master after all, you know, and you're the player. So, and I'm like, no, this is cooperative storytelling. It's, you know, you know, your ideas are just as important as the GM's ideas. It's just that the GM took the time to write up the scenario. So if you can, and so I said, here's a way of you changing the way the story goes, you know, hopefully not in a completely ridiculous fashion, but if that's the way it goes, that's the way it goes. And, but if you're creative, and it encourages the players to be creative, you know, you can change, like I said, the card that I'm always very hesitant to give out is like, you know, the big bad guy's, you know, minion turns against him. And it's like, okay, that's a great card because A, that can save you, you know, in a really bad situation. B, they can suddenly turn and stab their master in the big climatic battle scene where you either suddenly, you know, get to break free, or now they're not as powerful as they were before and you have a better chance of succeeding. And maybe they do it because you know them. Maybe maybe they remember you from a long time ago and you've forgotten who they are, but they're like, somebody that you knew, or they're related to you but distantly, or they want a change of life and they think you can give it to them and they're going to make this change. Or it could just be that they're just really, you know, the rules about being an evil overlord, one of the rules is always make sure yes. that your right hand man is really, really well compensated so he or she cannot be bribed. But in practice, a lot of times, they really aren't compensated. And that's why they might say, you know,
yeah,
I'm tired of, you know, I've been sucking up to this evil person for so long, and it really hasn't paid off. You know, I think it's time for there to be a change. And if you want a really good example of that, watch the movie Riddick.
Or the scene in Firefly where Jane shoots the two guys who's working with. He goes, "You get your own bunk. I don't get a bunk. I got to share it with him." And then he just bang, bang, and walks over to Mal and them. Yeah.
I thought you were going to talk. Yeah, the guy who basically turns on his group because, you know, the guy right before him got thrown into the propeller blades.
Yeah, that too. That's a good scene. But no, I was referring to where they first hired Jane. Oh, you get your own bunk.
Nice. Right. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Riddick, real quick. Riddick.
Basically in Riddick, there's Carl Urban. Beautiful.
Yeah.
So pretty. Carl Urban is like, you know, the heir apparent to this, you know, evil Cthulian lord, okay? But things just aren't going along very well for him. And his wife is very, she wants things to happen faster. And she convinces him that maybe he's not as powerful as he was, and maybe he's not upholding the philosophy of the necromongers the way he should be. And he's like, you know, you could be right. Well, I'm going to keep an eye on him. And if he doesn't act right, maybe it's time for a change. And then you've got the, you now have the rationale for that sudden change. Because when he's being threatened by a whole outside group, you know, it's a golden opportunity to, while he's distracted or weakened by them, to basically replace him. Anyways, it's really good. I didn't like the Pitch Black very much. I thought it was the stupid plot, but the second movie I thought was really well done. Even better than the third movie. I do recommend that. And I also recommend the video game, Riddick, Escape from Butcher Bay, where he's in prison trying to escape prison. And I've been told that that's a very... The graphics are fairly dated. I think it was done with Unreal or something similar to it. But the story itself, the gameplay, is actually supposed to be really good. And it's a really nice... If you like Riddick, if you're a fan of the series, then it's really worth your time to go and do that versus, you know, just looking at the movies. So anyways, but yeah, I love those cards. I highly recommend anybody to get your hands on those, add them to your game. If your players just don't react to them, you might just drop them because, you know, I mean, you're just beating yourself to death trying to get them to do something they don't want to do. But if they can see the benefit, then it can really transform your game. And that's what we're about. That's what we're gaming on the frontier. We're bringing the awesome to your game. That's one of the easy ways of doing it, by basically giving somebody a great big yes, you can do it card. You know, and they just have to look for a hole to plug it into. So, Trav, why don't you take us out?
Okay. Having your characters engage in downtime activities will ultimately enhance the character in many broad ways. They will gain personal growth. They will gain possibly economic growth, maybe even some moral and spiritual growth, depending on what it is that you're doing in your off time in between raiding dungeons or hunting monsters or traversing the plains or whatever. And in the end, whether you are urban fantasy, regular fantasy, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic, we all need to do things, even just the characters need to do things, even if just to regain spoons, as Christina Miseridino's spoon theory talks about. If you have other ideas on how characters can spend their downtime, or if we happen to have missed something, which I don't think we have, but if you wish to comment on this, you can contact us at Fans of Gaming on the Frontier podcast on Facebook. We still have the Bureau 13 Agents Everywhere and Fringeworthy RPG Fans groups on Facebook. You can comment to us on tritechsystems.podbean.com. Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. And of course, Bruce and I are, and Jonathan, we all have digital footprints. You can find us and talk to us, and we will answer your questions gladly about this or any other topics that we've mentioned. So yes, and it is, we are here to help you bring the awesome to your game. We will have more for all of you next week, but you will have to wait until then.
This is Bruce Sheffer saying there are a million, million worlds out there, so go explore them.
And this is Trav. There's a reason why it's called gaming. It's for having fun.
Gaming on the Frontier podcast is wholly owned by its hosts. It is released under the Creative Commons 3.0 license. No commercial reproduction, and any use of any element of the podcast must be attributed to the Gaming on the Frontier podcast. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Trav from the Travcast. Listen to me Tuesday nights, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on listen.dementiaradio.org/8027.